Welcome to the Cops and Writers Podcast. On this show, you will learn how to write the best crime-related novel or screenplay possible. Your host, Sergeant Patrick O'Donnell, worked the streets in one of the nation's largest police departments for over 25 years. Ride along with O'Donnell and his expert guests as they help you navigate the oftentimes confusing and misunderstood world of law enforcement. O'Donnell and his guests on this show do not represent any law enforcement agency. The content of this show is not meant to be legal advice. You think you need a lawyer? You probably do.
Hey, Cops and Writers, thanks for being here with us today for another episode of the Cops and Writers Podcast. I'm Patrick O'Donnell, and I'll be your host for today's show. My first order of business to thank those of you who are patrons of the show, most notably Frank Carson, Francis Sheldrick, Kathleen Donnelly, Fran Cross, Gary Edginton, J.K. Doan, Kathleen Kovacic, and Richard Towles. Your generosity helps pay for the software, equipment, and my time producing this show. Yes, you too can become a patron for less than a cup of coffee or a pint of Guinness. Just go on over to patreon.com/copsandwriters. I would also like to thank all of you who have purchased my books in the Cops and Writers series, available on Amazon. Today is episode one of a special two-part interview with retired death investigator and author Barbara Butcher of the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. The oldest of nine children, Barbara was born and raised in the city she loves, New York City. Barbara Butcher spent 23 years at the New York City Office of Chief Medical Examiner as a death investigator, director of the Forensic Sciences Training Program, and chief of staff. There she investigated more than 5,500 deaths, 680 of them homicides. She worked mass disasters, including 9/11, the 2004 tsunami in Thailand, the London Underground bombing, and the crash of Flight 587. During this interview, Barbara opens up and lets us into the life of a death investigator being confronted with death and profound sadness on a daily basis and the toll it took on her physical and mental health. We also have a candid talk about alcoholism and her rock bottom. Barbara also shares her recovery from this deadly disease and the good that came from it. I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. In today's episode, we discuss her interview on the James Altucher Show podcast and his notion that New York is dead. Spoiler alert, she doesn't think so. Her honesty and willingness to be vulnerable with her new book and this interview. Growing up in New York, being the oldest of nine kids, and her dad being on the New York Police Department, rising to the rank of deputy inspector. Ghosts or other paranormal feelings, being involved in 5,500 death investigations. Myths and misconceptions regarding alcoholism. Barbara hitting rock bottom with her drinking and rising from the ashes. How Barbara got the job with the New York Medical Examiner's Office as a death investigator and the training involved in her job. Her first time going to a death investigation solo. The job of death investigator. All this and more on today's episode of the Cops and Writers Podcast. Barbara Butcher, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Patrick. It's so good to be here.
You know, I've been looking forward to this all week. Ever since I read your book, I was like, I have to have this person on my podcast. You know, I don't get emotional. You know, it's like the common, you know, cop trope. You know, it's like, I was a sergeant. I was the one who kept everything under control at a scene, you know, blah, blah, blah. And there's very few books or movies or whatever, except maybe Brian's Song, you know, that really is a gut punch. You know, you're just like, wow. But reading your book, it was very moving. I was speechless, and I'm just like, man, I hope she says yes. So thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. I'm really glad that I made a cop emotional. That's big.
So before we get into the nitty gritty of everything, I usually don't give any kind of warnings because I put the explicit tag on my podcast because, you know, we talk about death. We talk about people's heads getting blown off. We talk about people getting shot or macheted or whatever the case may be. And I don't want a soccer mom full of kids in her minivan, you know, listening to this, you know, with them listening to it. But we will be touching on some dark stuff here. So if you feel like maybe this isn't your cup of tea, maybe you shouldn't listen to this particular episode. But I hope you do listen to this. I'm just really looking forward to it. So I first heard you, Barbara, on James Altucher's podcast. And I thought to myself, man, I have to talk to this person. It was such a good interview. And thank the you. One thing that jumped out at me was you used the word mope. And I laughed out loud. I was in the grocery store parking lot. I'm getting groceries. Yeah, I turned my car off and I'm like, I want to keep listening to this because I bought the audiobook. And you used the word mope. And I had an instant flashback of when I was a boss and people are throwing the word mope around. And one time, you know, I was the acting lieutenant and I had some cops in with an arrest. I said, well, what do you got? And he says, felonious mopery, Sarge. And I'm like, oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a felony in some places. Yes. So I thought to myself, okay, she's the real deal. She's talking the talk. She, you know, it's like, absolutely. So
it's a great word. It's a great it's a good little catch-all phrase, you know, mopery. Well, you're moping around, you're hanging around, you don't look right, but you don't quite look wrong. And it's just, there's all kinds of things. It's a feeling. It's a feeling more than an action.
It really is. Oh, but getting back to James's show, you know, he wrote an opinion piece, I think it was in the New York Times, about how New York City is dead. Mm. And I was thinking to myself, well, okay, Barbara Butcher is New York. You've got the swag. You've got, I mean, I think New York when I think Barbara Butcher. What do you think of that piece?
Well, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion, but unless you're in here doing the work, walking the walk and talking the talk, you can't say anything about New York. And if you think it's dying, well, then help revive it. New York is not dying. As a matter of fact, we may even go into a rebirth, a new iteration. There are some who talk about the fact that a lot of our commercial space is empty now. People don't have to go into the office. So right. What are we going to do with all that office space? Well, some say let's turn it into the entertainment capital of the world. We've already got Broadway. We've already got Madison Square Garden. We got the sports. We got the music. Let's go with it. And that may happen. But whatever happens, I don't leave New York. That's my town.
Okay. Yeah, I know Seinfeld shot back. Yeah, he did kind of a opposing scene to that. And yeah, and you know, I love James. I listen to his podcast quite religiously. And James, if you're listening to this, I'd love to have you on the show and I would love to be on your show. I just, yeah, but I was
it's a good show. It's a very
it
good
is.
Show.
And I was just interested to see what your take on that was. And the thing that I shouldn't say bothers me, but when people throw out big, not accusations, but you know, big statements like that, you should have some kind of solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I'm going to say, you know what, you know, yeah, these cars are speeding up and down my car, you know, my street, you know, all night and all day, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, did you talk to your alderman? Did you call police? Did you do anything? Or do you even have an idea?
That's what your city councilman is for.
Right.
They got
exactly.
People that sit there and listen to your complaints all day long.
Yeah, it's good for them. So I wanted to thank you for your honesty and being vulnerable in this book and this interview. That's not an easy thing to do. How did you come to terms with that? You know, writing this book, there's a lot of personal stuff in there. I mean, did you just throw caution to the wind and say, heck, let's just do this?
No, they had to drag me kicking and screaming. Are you kidding? You know, I don't do vulnerable. I'm a death investigator. We learn to detach, just like police officers. We learn to detach from our feelings. If you got emotional at a scene, you know, you see a woman and her child killed. Of course, your heart goes on fire, but you have to shut it down so you can do your work, get justice for the family, get justice for the victim, right? So I am rather detached from my emotions. And at first, when I wrote the book, it was just a collection of my interesting cases, the crazy murders I've worked on, the crazy suicides, accidents, all kinds of interesting cases. And then my editor said, where are you? I said, what do you mean? I'm over here writing. He said, where are you in the book? Where are your feelings? What did you see and hear and smell? What did you feel? I said, oh, okay, I can do that. I started doing it. And, you know, I won't lie, I cried a little bit sometimes when I remembered some of these deaths.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, with time and distance, you know, now I can go ahead and feel it. But it was not easy. And then once I wrote about some of my flaws, my character flaws, which are many, I decided, what the hell, let's just go with it. Maybe somebody will pick up something from what I learned.
You know, just writing a book and hitting the publish button is making yourself vulnerable. You're opening yourself up to all kinds of trolls, you know, all the naysayers, the people who aren't happy unless they're unhappy and they want to make everybody else unhappy. Yeah, and it takes a lot of guts. I admire anybody who writes a book and hits that publish button, because there's so many people out there that talk about it. They say like 80% of people in the country have a book in them. You know, they all, oh yeah, I could write a book about this, and they probably do, but a very small fraction ever go ahead with it. And I know writers that have full manuscripts, edited covers, just good to go, polished and ready to rock, and they will not hit that publish button. They're petrified.
Scary.
It is.
Yeah. You know, you're bearing your soul. You're saying, here, world, go ahead and judge me if you, you know.
Exactly.
And, you know, but I learned in certain programs that I have attended that what other people think of me is none of my business. I got to live my life best I can. And if other people don't like my life, that's okay. They are entitled to their opinions.
Gotcha. So you were born and raised in New York, correct?
Mm-hmm. Born in Brooklyn, raised on Long Island, Massapequa Park, per se, home of the guy that was just arrested for the Gilgo Beach murders, which is astounding to me. I mean, this case has been going on for 10, 11, 12, 13 years now.
Wow. Holy
catfish. Serial killer. And they finally picked him up. Where? 3 blocks from my house.
Really?
So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dang.
Accused. What's the word? Yeah.
Accused. Yes. Accused serial killer.
Suspected.
Yes. Yes. Now, how many people did he kill? Do you know?
Or 11.
Holy. Wow. That's a lot.
Yep.
Dang. So you're one of 9 children.
Mm-hmm.
And well, we're all good Irish Catholic people, right? You know, so
yes. How did you guess?
it's what we have to do. I mean, both of my parents are from Ireland, full disclosure.
Ah.
So, you know, it's like if you weren't Irish, you have to be Catholic. And if you're not, there's a small percentage that are Protestant and everybody else is an alien from another planet, according to my mom, you know. So that's just the way it is. So one of 9, and your dad was a copper in NYPD, correct?
Yes, I was the oldest of 9. My dad was with NYPD since the late 1940s, right after the war. Wow. Came out of the Navy, joined the force, and worked his way up all the way to deputy inspector before he retired. And it was something that was of great admiration in the neighborhood. Everybody loved having a cop. When he came home in his uniform, all the kids used to run to see him. It was a big deal.
Well, I'll tell you what. One thing that they taught us in the academy, and it was 100% true, was everybody on your block is going to know you're a cop. Whether you come home in a uniform or not, does not matter how much you try to hide it or whatever, everybody's going to find out.
Yep. Yeah. You wear the job, even without the uniform. It's all over you.
That's very true. So any other family members or friends become police officers?
Sure. Let's see. I had my cousins. I have 3 cousins who are cops on my dad's side, and an uncle who is a firefighter, who was a firefighter. None of us kids became police officers. I wanted to, but that was back in the late 1960s, and women weren't quite so welcome then.
Mm.
And I wore glasses, so that wasn't that welcome either. In fact, I think back then you had to have perfect eyesight. But that's what my father told me. He didn't want me to go on the force.
He said,
look, they're going to take you, they chew you up, spit you out, they'll destroy you. So
we want better for our children. And, you know, I can understand what your pops is saying, because, you know, with my kids, I don't want them to be cops. You know, it's a great job. It has given me so much. I mean, yeah, there were bad times and there's politics and there's BS, but any job where you're serving others is so fulfilling. And you don't realize that until you have that job. And that is my biggest takeaway. If anybody's even thinking about becoming, you know, a cop or a firefighter or whatever, you know, again, anything of service to humanity, boy, you can't get any better than that, I don't think.
Yep. It's God's work. Yep.
It is. Lots of dead bodies that you've been around. Your bio on Amazon says 5,500 death scenes, 680 were homicides. Did you ever encounter or have any feelings of like ghosts or like any kind of weird stuff going on at a death scene or like after?
We'll be right back.
Today's episode is sponsored by the thrilling audiobook Avenging Adam, book one in the FBI canine thriller series written by author Jodi Burnett. Sparks fly between hotshot FBI agent Rick Sanchez and no-nonsense FBI canine handler Kendra Dean as they chase a ruthless serial killer. Witness an electrifying blend of suspense, romance, and redemption, where internal conflicts challenge our heroes as much as their target does. Will they catch the killer before it's too late? Grab Avenging Adam now. It's more than a story. It's an experience. Get 50% off the Avenging Adam audiobook at jodi-burnett.com/copsandwriters.
Not in any cases that I investigated specifically. However, okay. Well, first of all, people used to ask me, isn't it kind of spooky at the morgue? Isn't it full of ghosts? And I explained that no, people didn't die there. The people died elsewhere, and that's where their ghosts would be, if there are any. When we get them, they've left their souls and their spirits behind. But in my mother's, the home where she grew up out in Greenport, Long Island, her uncle shot himself in the head up on a stair landing many, many years ago, and also shot his wife.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, shot her first. It was a murder-suicide. So on that stair landing, when I was a kid and we'd go there to that house to visit my great-grandmother, there was a cold spot. And running through there, we used to get like that weird feeling in the pit of your stomach.
Yeah.
And my mother, and I didn't know what it was, but when my mother was a little girl, she'd sleep up there and she'd hear people crying and fighting from a long way away. And finally, she asked my great-grandmother, "What is that? What's that noise?" And she said, "Oh, that's," she's Italian. She says, "That's where your uncle, he kill his wife, then he kill himself. Bastard." So I do think that there are some manifestations of energy. Call it a ghost. I don't know what.
Yeah.
But I think there's some kind of energy there. Who knows? It's the only one I've ever seen, though.
Okay. Now, reading your book, one of the themes that comes out fairly early is your struggle with alcoholism.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What are some of the biggest myths and misconceptions that you see with people when it comes to alcoholism?
Oh, probably the number one is that it's a moral failing, that if you wanted to, you could just stop. That being an alcoholic means you're a bum, you're no good, you're weak. None of those things are true. I'm very strong. I'm not a bum. And it's a chemical thing. It's genetic. Who knows what? But it's a disease. It's an actual disease, addiction. Some scientists think that it's the dopamine receptors in your brain. They don't have sufficient uptake of dopamine and other molecules. Whatever it is, all I know is that if I had one drink, then I had to have five. If I didn't take a drink, I'm fine. I don't feel any craving. But once you have that one, it starts this little engine of craving, and you've got to have more and more and more. I find the same thing with sugar too, so I have to avoid that. So whatever it was, alcoholism is a disease. And A person who's getting along pretty well in life, but drinking heavily, is probably not going to quit, even if their drinking bothers a person or two, like their wife or husband.
Yeah.
But then there comes a time when suddenly it all goes bad, because inevitably it will. And that's when you hit, you know, they say you hit bottom, you hit rock bottom. For me, that was one summer night. I was out with friends and we were at a little Chinese restaurant where they gave out free wine with dinner. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I'd make an appetizer and an entree stretch 2.5 hours so I could have all the free wine. And it tasted just like turpentine. Came right out of a box. You know, it was terrible, but I loved it. And once I started it, I couldn't stop. So I got very, very, very drunk that night. Then we went out and met other friends and had more drinks. I don't know what happened after that. It was a complete blackout. I'm told that I gave all my money to a beggar in the street. And I asked him, are you going to use this to buy drugs? He said, yeah. I said, oh, good. That's honest of you. Here's $80. So, yeah, I know. Stupid, right? So I had a blackout. I fell in the street. I fell up the stairs, which is hard to do unless you're really drunk. And I woke up on the floor in a tangle of sweaty sheets. And I felt sicker than I had ever felt in my life. And looking around me, I saw my little apartment. It was 170 square feet, a shitty little studio.
That's a closet. That's not an apartment.
No, it's a closet.
Yep.
A shitty little place on Riverside Drive in Manhattan. And the windowsill, the one window, was filled with dirty pigeons sitting there pooping on my windowsill and clucking and driving me crazy. And that was my life. I worked off the books in a button store. And when I woke up so sick, so overwhelmed with the wastedness of how I felt, I realized I don't have a life. I have nothing.
How old were you?
Let's see. That was 1991. So I was 40 years old.
Okay. All right. I mean, you're an educated person. And before the drinking and all that, what did you do for a living?
I had a master's degree from Columbia University. Yeah. I had a bachelor's degree in science, and I was a physician assistant. I was working in surgery. Then I became a hospital administrator. I had great jobs.
Yeah.
But the drinking sort of went up and down, up and down. I'd go through phases, but I always managed to control it. But then for me, it's all about loss. Loss is my big trigger. In one period of time, I lost my great job as a hospital administrator. My relationship broke up. My brother died of a heroin overdose.
Oh.
And then I lost my apartment. My landlord took it over. And so I lost everything, my identity, my family, it was a mess. And then I really went to town with the drinking.
Yeah. Did you talk to like friends or family or reach out to them and saying, hey, things are getting really bad here. You know, could you help?
No, I don't do that. who asks for help? I'm too arrogant. Until that one day that I woke up on the floor, that's the first time I asked for help. I walked into an AA meeting and I stayed. I stayed for 32 years. I'm still sober.
Wow. You know, I was going to ask you, do you remember your first meeting?
Oh, God, yes. I was so embarrassed. I thought, oh, my God, who are these people? I don't want anybody to see me going in because then they'll think I'm an alcoholic. Come on, honey. Everybody knew.
Everybody in this room is an alcoholic.
And everyone who knew me knew I was an alcoholic. They just hadn't really discussed it much. But
now quitting the booze, you know, that is the one drug that when you're going through withdrawals, it could actually kill you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I did not know this until I became a cop. And I went to whatever, you know, man down or whatever. And yeah, he's going through DTs. And I'm like, okay, I know what those are. And it's like, yeah, he's an alcoholic and we got to get him to a hospital. He's going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, the paramedics. And I'm like, you could die from drinking too. You know, I know you can die from drinking too much, but if you're trying to quit, sometimes you could die from trying to quit.
Oh, sure. I have seizures and die. Yeah. I was lucky. My drinking was pretty much confined to after 6 o'clock, from 6 to midnight.
Mm.
So I had, you know, periods to wash out the alcohol.
Okay. Okay.
So I didn't have much of a withdrawal. I felt very sick, but I didn't have seizures or anything okay. like that.
Is there such thing as a high functioning alcoholic?
Oh, sure. Sure. I think for a period of time I was high functioning until I wasn't, you know, it's like one right. day. Oh, sure. There are plenty of people who can control the drinking or put it within certain hours, like I did in the yeah. evening. So people weren't going to notice as much. I managed to go to work most every day.
Wow. So do you still crave it?
Not at all. Not at all. One little bit. I crave candy. Hershey's chocolate nuggets.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I love dark chocolate. Oh, my God. Yeah. This dark chocolate M&Ms. Yeah, those mm-hmm, good mm-hmm. stuff. Now, can you just have one drink, like socially? You're at a wedding or whatever. It just cannot happen.
No, it cannot happen. There's absolutely no point to it, because what would it gain me?
Right.
As you see in the book, getting sober gained me everything. The whole world opened up for me. And I was incredibly lucky in my career, in my relationships, in everything. But one little drink, so I might relax a tiny bit more, but what am I risking my whole life?
Yeah, you don't know.
No,
I
would never do it. No.
So I'm a writer, and there's lots of writers listening to this show for research. If you want to go to an AA meeting, how do you do this respectfully as mm-hmm. possible?
You go to what's called an open meeting. If you go online, you look at, see where the meetings are in your town, and you look for open meetings. And those are meetings for alcoholics or people who are curious about alcoholism, or, you know, they have questions about their own drinking. Everyone's welcome.
Okay. So what good came from your alcoholism?
Everything. You see, one of the things you get as an alcoholic, if you're lucky enough to live in certain states like New York states, you get what's called vocational help. I got something called EPRA, the Employment Program for Recovering Alcoholics. You don't need to go to AA to get this. You just need to be an alcoholic in recovery. And they give you training. They teach you how to work among people, how to be humble. And they give you all kinds of fabulous tests, Minnesota multiphasic, Myers-Briggs personality, this, that, and the other thing. And at the end of those tests, my counselor said to me, Barbara, you should either be a poultry veterinarian or a coroner.
Poultry veterinarian. I saw that in the book and I'm like, what in the hell is a poultry veterinarian?
Chickens, taking care of chickens. I said, well, wait a minute. Why poultry? I understand veterinarian because I'm good at diagnostics, you know, as a PA and working in surgery. And I said, but why poultry? He said, well, you know, if you work with puppies and kittens, you're going to get upset when they die. It's too emotional. But chickens, they got beady little eyes. Nobody cares about chickens. I said, I'll take the dead people. I'll take coroner. Because I figured, you know, if the person's already dead, I'm not going to get attached. I'm not going to get emotionally bereft. You know, like when I lost a patient, I used to be very upset. So I didn't realize, though, that those dead people have families.
Yes.
They have families who you have to work with, you have to comfort and help. And that's heartbreaking work. Really, really heartbreaking.
Certainly is. So how did you get your job at the medical examiner's office? How did that happen?
Well, my counselor in this EPRA program, he said, I want you to call a person in New York who you think has the best job in the world. Ask them if you can just come in and talk to them about their work. People love talking about their work. So I called Dr. Charles Hirsch, the chief medical examiner. And he was so gracious. He said, sure, come on in. And we talked. He told me about the work. And I didn't know it at the time, but they had an opening for an investigator. And they offered me the job. Well, I damn near fell on the floor. It was like, wow, this is a dream come true. Because when I was a kid, I got a dissecting kit as a gift and a frog in formaldehyde. And I loved doing little experiments, opening it up, see how it died. And the kids in the neighborhood would bring me their little roadkill, squirrels and raccoons and stuff. And I'd look and say, oh, yeah, you see those tire treads right across the center of the abdomen there? That's what happened. He got run over. So I was always interested in science, always naturally curious. Actually, I'm quite nosy when it comes down to it. But this was a dream job, investigating deaths. It was almost like being a cop. I could hang out with cops. I could do exciting things. Oh, I was so happy.
What did your dad say when you told him that you got a job at the Emmys?
He was a little nervous. He said, don't forget what I told you. New York City, you work for the city, they're going to get you. They're going to kill you. It's soul-crushing work. I said, all right, I'll do it. I don't care.
Now, when you were younger, did you watch the television show Quincy?
Oh, of course. Love that show.
You know, yeah. So Quincy is, he's on the scene and he's investigating with his faithful companion, Sam. And he's at the scene. And then later on, he's cutting up the body. And I'm like, it doesn't work like that. But, you know, and the beginning is about as cheesy as a 70s TV show could be, where he's living on a sailboat with some babe in a bikini and he's wearing a sweater vest. You know, here's some old ME guy wearing a sweater vest. And oh, yeah, the chicks really dig that, you know.
Definitely a chick magnet. Most people are not aware of what a medical legal death investigator does, because on TV they have a forensic pathologist who drops what he's doing at the autopsy table and runs out to a homicide,
starts
poking around, hanging with the cops, he's interviewing witnesses, he's solving the whole case himself. That's not it at all. Forensic pathologists don't go out to scenes generally. They're in the middle of autopsies. So what the forensic pathologist learns in an autopsy is the cause of death: gunshot wound, cancer, heart attack, stab wound. And what they don't know, though, is whether or not this is a homicide, a suicide, or an accident, or a natural. For that, they need the context in which the person died, the death scene. So it's the job of the medical legal death investigator to go to that scene, work with the police, examine the body, examine the scene, record it with photographs, diagrams, and interview the family members or any witnesses along with the police. We work together. Then I write a report and hand that over with the photographs to the forensic pathologist. And now they see, you know, there was a gun at the scene. It was in his hand in a sort of a spasm. It was gunshot residue along the web of his hand, and it was a contact wound to the side of his temple, and the doors were locked, and there's a note. Okay, it's a suicide. But only you can only tell that by understanding the context of the scene. So that was my job, to find the manner of death.
That's what I was going to ask about next, is the cause and manner of death. Those two things are different. Mm-hmm. So you get on the job. Was there on the job training, or how did they train you up?
Well, back then, to be a death investigator in New York, you had to be a physician assistant or a physician, so that you had the medical background. Yeah.
Okay.
Originally, they used just guys, funeral directors, coroners, you know, people without a medical background. But
yeah,
Dr. Hirsch changed that. So what they gave me was investigative training. For 3 months, I went on every damn death in New York. And you know, there was a lot back then.
We were having
2,400 homicides a year. 2,400. Now, you look, if you get 300, everybody starts screaming.
Yeah.
But we were seeing them all day long. and I would go on every case. Then I went to NYPD at the academy for their homicide course and their criminal investigations course, then special victims. I went to the FBI academy for they have a week-long scene investigation course. So I got all the every piece of education I could grab on that. I loved going to those seminars and courses.
Do you know if it's still that way with the ME's office in New York? You don't have to be a physician or a PA anymore to be a death investigator, do you?
No, you need to have a master's degree in some branch of forensic science.
Okay.
You can, you know, they still use PAs, but they're hiring people with master's degrees. And then they give them the training for a death investigation.
Now, what year was it that you got on the ME's office?
September of 1992.
So 92. No, from reading the book, that was a very male-dominated office, correct?
Everything was male-dominated, not just my office. You know, it was, yeah, I was the second woman hired, the first to last more than 3 months. The woman hired before me, she ran out screaming. You know, I don't know if it was because the guy's given her a hard time or because of the work, but
maybe a combination, who knows?
Probably.
But, you know, in Milwaukee, where I am, when I was brand new, it was the opposite. Almost all the investigators from the ME's office were women.
Wow.
And I think the reason for that, and I got hired in 95. So I believe the reason was a lot of them, if not all of them, were nurses before.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a very female dominated, you know, back then, at least it was mostly women that were nurses. You know, obviously that's changed through the years, but I think that's why. And I always thought that in the back of my head. And I'm like, how come there's no guys doing this? You know, I don't understand, but okay, well, whatever. You know, I mean, you know, and you had your great, you had your rock stars and you had your just turds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Should not be doing this job. You know, you're like, wow. But you also had some, and it's like, okay, I'm like, oh, cool, it's Jenny. You know, it's like you get to know everybody.
Yep. It's a calling, and some people just have a talent for it.
Yes. So you're the only woman in the office. How was that? How did they treat you?
You know, at first, they give me a little bit of a hard time. They kept showing me photos of like squashed heads and, you know, crazy things, you know, people splattered on the ground from jumping from a building. And I'd say, oh, that's very interesting. I wonder about that wound angle there. You know, what's that for? Left-handed guy with a knife. Then they gave up on that.
Okay.
They kept trying to mansplain to me.
Mansplain, I love it.
And you know, one of the guys who I call Reuven in the book, we became good friends. You know, but he still would explain everything to me endlessly. And when we finally hired another woman a couple of years later, he said, oh, great. Now there's more of them. We're going to have to, you know, act differently. I said, more of who? Smart people? He said, ah, there's more women here. It's going to be different. I said, I shouldn't. I called him a name. I said, don't worry about it, you silly CS. And, you know, it was the same thing. I joined the fire department. I was a volunteer firefighter up in Mountain Dale, New York.
Okay.
Again, the first woman on the fire department. And they were like, oh, damn it. Now we can't curse or anything. I said, come on, don't be a pussy. You can say whatever shit you want in front of me.
You know, and if the guys don't give you shit, then they don't like you.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've seen. My first partner on the job was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And we were both in very, she had more time on than I did. She had about 5 years on the job. And we were both kind of in similar situations where we both had little kids. We worked midnight to 8. And we just ran out of sleep. You know, the kids were number one. And we both had pretty shitty marriages. And just, we were two peas in a pod. And we're still besties to this day. You know, and just, I got a front row seat to what it was like, you know, because back then your partner was your partner. You rode with him almost every night and, you know, family barbecues, birthdays, all that kind of stuff, you know, you become very, very close.
That partnership is a beautiful thing.
It is. And unfortunately, with police numbers dwindling like they are, I still have friends that are, you know, active police officers now, and or I see, you know, I see them at the gym or whatever, and those days are dissipating. And I'm like, I don't like to hear that, because that was your therapy.
Yeah.
You know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. You're talking about something ugly that happened either on the job or something that's shitty at home. You know, yep. That's your sounding board, is your partner. And I've had great partners. I went out, had a beer with one of my partners last night, you know, and we were partners 15 years ago, yeah. Thereabouts, you know, just, yeah. And that makes me sad that that's kind of going out the door. And I hope it rebounds, you know, just, that's terrible.
Yeah. It's emotionally necessary. That's a lifelong bond.
It is. So do you remember the first ever job that you went out to as an investigator, or the first one you went out to solo?
Yes. I remember my first solo case. My first, during the training, there were just too many.
Sure.
But my first solo case, I was so excited.
What a feeling, huh?
Yeah. I had a homicide over in a park, along Riverside Park, near a basketball court. And I got there, and I had a little trench coat on, just like the cops, you know.
Yeah.
Suit, little trench coat. And it was a couple of guys, and they're like, hi, who are you? I said, I'm Butcher from the ME. They're like, whoa, Butcher. Cool name, honey. And I decided, well, I'm going to show these guys what I could do. And, you know, it was one of those unsolvable homicides. It was a guy with no ID, no name, no nothing. Nothing. And he had sweatpants and a t-shirt. That was it. And not even a pair of sneakers. It was barefoot. So nothing we could tell about him. All he had was a gunshot wound to his head in the middle of an open field. Well, what the hell are you going to do with that? So as I examined him, you know, I started looking at that gunshot wound. And I said, you know, this is a very close contact wound. We've got blowback. We've got the...
is there like burn?
Yeah.
Like we've got... Burn? Okay.
Yeah. We've got, you know, emanation of brain tissue from the skull, and we've got the powder burns that rim the mm-hmm. burn from the inside of the hot gun barrel.
Right.
I said, I wonder who could walk up to him like this and just shoot him in the head.
Right.
Maybe, just maybe, it's a suicide. And someone else walking past him saw the gun and said, oh, great, a free gun.
Absolutely.
And boy, did they love that, because, you know, it's so much easier to clear a suicide.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Than it is a homicide. So, you know, they had respect for me at that moment. They said, wow, she's looking to keep an open mind. She's looking at all the options. And, you know, I became friends with those guys. And, of course, being the goofy little newbie that I was, I said, would you guys mind taking a picture with me? This is my first homicide. So we all stood in a nice little group, and my driver took a picture of us. And I was really excited. I kept that on my bulletin board for years with a little label, my first homicide.
Oh,
I was
my
very
God.
Proud of that.
Do you still have that picture?
No, someone took it off my bulletin board. I'm
so
mad.
That's,
would love to have that.
That's so wrong. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So you're on your way, you know, obviously you start building confidence, more skills as you're going along here. What's your self-talk on your way to a scene? Or is there like a way that you try to psych yourself up or get mentally prepared for this?
Oh, sure. You know, when they call dispatch, when an officer called dispatch and say, I've got a homicide in the 2-4 precinct. And then the dispatcher would call me and say, it's a homicide. I said, no, no, no. It's not a homicide until I say it's a homicide.
Absolutely.
So I had learned early on through AA, of all places, they said, take your hands off your ears and put them over your mouth. Learn to listen. You know?
I love it.
Don't have preconceived notions. Don't make assumptions. Don't walk in there thinking it's a homicide. Walk in there thinking it's an open case of a deceased person, period. And that's what I did. I would go in there and I'd ask the HMFIC, the head mother in charge.
You can say fuck, that's okay.
Okay, the head motherfucker in charge. You know, I'd identify him from the police department. I'd walk up, ask him, what do you got here? And he'd give me his, you know, whatever information they had. And then I'd go over and I'd start observing the scene. Before I even went to the body, I'd just try to take the whole scene in. You know, if you go to a place where they've got books all over the walls and tote bags from PBS and a nice little furnished house, that tells you something about a person's life. If you go in another apartment and they got little scales with white powder and lots of tattoos and stuff like that, you know, it's another feeling. So I'd like to get a feeling for the whole scene. Mm. And then, you know, do my photos. And I always waited for crime scene before I started messing with the body. When the crime scene unit got there, then we'd work together, do our photographs of the body. I'd move it around. I'd show them what I thought was interesting or probative evidence. And I really developed a great relationship with the police. I love those guys. Love every one of them.
You know,
good people.
When I was new, you know, at my first homicide or suicide or whatever, and the ME investigator came, I didn't realize that it was two specific, separate investigations where, you know, I remember Jenny Penn was the first ME that responded to a scene, and she had her bag and she had a digital camera. She starts taking pictures and I'm like, oh, okay. I said, you know, we have, you know, forensic investigators that have, you know, cameras. They, she said, no, that's different. I'm like, oh, okay. So she, you know, she explained it to me. She said, you know, I do my thing. Homicide does their thing. And we all work in, you know, concert, or at least we should all work in concert, where technically we can't touch that body until you got to that scene.
That's right.
We can't
go digging
through pockets.
To me.
Right. Yeah. The body and the contents, you know, pockets and, you know, moving stuff around. You don't do any of that until the ME gets there.
Yeah. The body belongs to the ME and the scene belongs to the police. However, the two are so integral to each other to solving the case that we do have to work together. We have a separate and independent investigation, but it's in collaboration with, no, that's the wrong word, not collaboration. It's in concert.
Yeah, in concert. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. I got to look at the scene. They have to look at the body. So, but sometimes our opinions are going to differ and that's okay.
Sure. Now, tools of the trade. When you got to a scene and you've got a dead body there, what are some of the things you're going to be doing, like in a particular order? Or it doesn't even have to be in a particular order, but what are you going to be doing physically? You know, and what are you going to do?
First, I take pictures of the whole scene, you know, every point of the compass, and then I close in on the body. And once crime scene gets there, I'm going to examine that body. I'm going to look at every aspect of it. I'm going to not remove the clothing because you can lose valuable evidence that way.
Absolutely.
Entry and exit wounds, you're going to be able to tell by the fibers, and you know that's a big help, especially when it's a multiple gunshot wound case. Mm-hmm. In fact, Dr. Hirsch used to say, I would rather autopsy 7 people with gunshot wounds than one person with 7 gunshot wounds. Because it's so hard to track those and see, you know, who shot where, were there different projectiles, different shooters. Anyway, I would zero in on the body and then carefully examine every aspect of it. You can get surprised sometimes. You say, this guy's got a gunshot wound in his head. And then you notice, if you lift up his shirt, that there are maggots in the center of his chest. Now, maggots don't belong in the center of the chest. They go into the openings of the body, the nose, the mouth, the eyes, ears. But if there's an opening in his chest, like a stab wound, that's why the maggots are going to go. So that's happened several times to me. So document the scene, examine the body, then examine the scene. I go look in the medicine cabinets for drugs or medications. Now, look in the refrigerator. If there are 80 bottles of alcohol and no food, then, you know, something's up.
Yeah, those are clues, yes.
Yeah, clues, yes. Yeah. And then I would, you know, work with the police and say, look, here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that this is a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And even though the gun is about 4 feet away from the body, I think that's a result of a cadaveric spasm or throwing the gun to the side. But I should put a little disclaimer in there. When I walked into any scene, the first thing I would ask is, what has changed since you got here?
Did anybody
open windows? Did anybody move the gun? Did they roll the body around? Tell me now.
Thank you for joining myself and my special guest, author and death investigator, Barbara Butcher, of the City of New York Medical Examiner's Office for part one of this special episode. Tune in next week for the conclusion of this potent discussion. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Cops and Writers Podcast. If you haven't done so yet, can you take a minute and rate and review the show on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts? If you have already, thank you. As always, thank you for all of your support, and, of course, let's be careful out there.